Blog Talk Radio.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know what? You would say, hey, everybody, James Bostic here, Conservative's Perspective. It's Tuesday night, and we're live on the Patriot Nation Radio Network at Blog Talk Radio. But you wouldn't say that. I would say that. But you would say, to me, if you said to someone today, you mentioned the name Henry Mancini, there's a large number of people out there, I mean a large number of people out there that would think hokey, you know? They would think Pink Panther. They wouldn't think Peter Gunn. But that cat really knew how to swing. Yes, it's James Bostic here. Conservative's Perspective on a terribly cold, a discommodious cold, frigid even, Tuesday night here in the Mountain State. It's pretty big. Because, you know, most of the country, you know, is up to their butt in either snow or frigid temperatures. Or any combination of the two. And so, and of course, it's a lot worse in other places, but it's pretty cold here nonetheless. I mean, up around the Great Lakes, they're looking at wind chills of 50 below. Frostbite is unavoidable in under 5 minutes if you go outside. That's dangerous. That'll kill you. And it's terrible up there, and we pray that this ends, the extreme winter weather that we're seeing eases up. I mean, it's winter, we get it, cold and snow, right on. But let's go up, let's ease up a little bit there. So a lot of things going on, as usual. And one of the things I want to share with you is a clip. There's a fellow out there by the name of Mark Levin, who is a really, really bright guy. He interned as a law clerk for one of the Supremes, but it wasn't Diana Ross. It was one of the other ones. And then later he worked in the Reagan White House. He's a longtime conservative commentator. He's got a he's an author. He's a Fox News contributor. He's got his own network thing going. Clear Conservative, CCR, Clear Conservative. Anyway, he's talking with Sidney Powell, another Washington insider, and we're going to get caught up on what's going on with Robert Mueller and this runaway necktie party that we call the Mueller Independent Counsel Investigation. It's a little long, and I apologize for that, but you know how it is. And it's only one of about a half a dozen clips that we're going to play. But this is, I've got a couple, and you know how I am sometimes. Anyway, this is a good clip. It's worth listening to. Mark Levin with Sidney Powell, I think it was from Sunday night, talking about what's going on with the, a breakdown on the Mueller investigation.
Hello, America. I'm Mark Levin. This is Life, Liberty, and Levin, a great guest. Sidney Powell, how are you, my friend?
Great, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
My honor, former federal prosecutor. You were, in fact, this is quite remarkable, you worked at the Department of Justice for 10 years. You worked in three federal districts under 9 different United States attorneys. It's not that you changed, it's that they change over the course of time when a new administration comes in or what have you. And these U.S. attorneys were appointed by presidents of both parties. Right?
Exactly.
And you also have been counsel, lead counsel, in more than 500 federal appeals, 350 of them as an assistant United States attorney and appellate section chief in the Western and Northern districts of Texas. I just want our audience to know how significant that is, how impressive that is, because there's a lot of brilliant assistant United States attorneys out there. And you were one of them.
Thank you.
And I want to take a very, very close look at Robert Mueller's office. A lot of people focus on Robert Mueller, and they should. But the Svengalian there, my word, is the number two guy who Mueller relies on for everything, Andrew Weissmann. So let's focus a little bit on Andrew Weissmann so the American people know who he is and knows who really is the, in many cases, the Wizard of Oz. Tell us about Andrew Weissmann.
Well, I've called Mr. Weissmann the poster boy for prosecutorial misconduct because Mueller had a role in handpicking him for head of the Enron task force and appointing him to that position.
And what was Mueller at the time?
Mueller was in the FBI at the time.
He was the director of the FBI.
Yes.
So he picks Weissmann to handle the Enron case.
Yes. Weissmann was deputy director at the time when it first started under Leslie Caldwell, who was the chief of the Enron task force when it was first created in the collapse of Enron. So they set about and targeted Arthur Andersen to begin with, the venerable accounting firm.
So they're investigating Enron.
Yes.
And they target Arthur Andersen.
Yes.
For what?
For destroying evidence is what they called it. But they did it by making up a crime, by combining two separate statutes to create a crime out of something that wasn't. So they destroyed Arthur Andersen. They knew they were going to destroy the company.
How did they destroy Arthur Andersen?
By indicting it.
They indict Arthur Andersen because they're the financial advisors to Enron.
Exactly. They were the auditors and financial advisors to Enron.
And they manufacture a crime by combining two different statutes.
Exactly.
And at that time, how many people worked for Arthur Andersen?
85,000 people worked for Arthur Andersen.
85,000 people. And Weissmann was the lead investigator.
He was the lead prosecutor on that case.
And he reported, in part, he informed the director of the FBI at the time, Mueller.
Yes.
Okay. Well, what did they do?
Well, they knew they were going to destroy the company when they indicted it because Andersen represented 2,500 publicly traded companies. And no auditor who represents publicly traded companies can function as an auditor when they're indicted. So they sealed the indictment for a week while they...
They indict them. Seal the indictment for a week.
Yes.
That's absolute disaster for accountants, auditors, financial advisors.
Yes.
Okay.
And they worked behind the scenes during that week to avoid upheaval in the markets so that when they announce the indictment and unseal it publicly, the markets are not as disruptive as they would have been if they had just indicted them publicly immediately.
What did they indict Arthur Andersen for?
They indicted them under a witness tampering statute. And the way they did it, they took criminal intent out of the process. And in fact, when the Supreme Court later got the case, Justice Rehnquist wrote the decision for the majority, well, for the unanimous Supreme Court, and said it was shocking how little criminal culpability the jury instructions had required, and that the Andersen had not committed a crime at the time.
So Andersen gets caught up in this Enron case. Weissman must know that there wasn't mens rea or criminal culpability. He indicts the entity, which for a major international corporation is a disaster to begin with, because then you get documents subpoenaed and so forth, and you have to be searching your computers and your records here and all over the world and so forth. So it creates great tumult in a company.
Completely.
And that in and of itself, depending on the nature of the subpoenas and the indictment and so forth, can freeze a company. And so here's this company, Arthur Andersen, that's in the business of protecting other companies. They're auditors. They're accountants. They're financial advisors. And they're being accused of what? Witness tampering?
Yes, an obstruction of justice under two different statutes that combined created this new offense, because there wasn't one. Andersen had not been subpoenaed for any documents at the time. Andersen was cleaning up his files and proceeding to get ready for the investigation. So they just made up a new offense by combining the two different statutes.
Now, do you call the name of the federal trial judge that was involved in the case?
Melinda Harmon in Houston.
Melinda Harmon in Houston. And then I assume they appealed it?
Andersen did appeal it.
And what happened on appeal?
The Fifth Circuit affirmed it on appeal.
Affirmed it. Then they appeal it to the United States Supreme Court, which takes the case, which is relatively rare.
Yes.
And the justices look at this. You mentioned Rehnquist. And they say, wait a minute. There's no criminal intent. There's no criminal culpability. This isn't even really a statute. The instructions were faulty. And what did the Supreme Court rule?
They reversed it unanimously.
Unanimously. Every justice said no.
Exactly.
What happened to Mr. Weissman since he led the case?
Oh, absolutely nothing. Mr. Weissman went on to become director of the Enron Task Force.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he had already, by the time Andersen was reversed, he had already turned his sights on the Merrill Lynch defendants in what was called the Enron or Nigerian barge case, and indicted four Merrill Lynch executives on a multi-count indictment in which they also made up a crime.
I want to get to that in a minute. What happened to Andersen?
Andersen was destroyed the minute it was indicted.
It collapsed.
It collapsed. Not only was it under criminal indictment, so it lost all its clients, but I think 160 civil plaintiffs piled on in multiple lawsuits.
So it was crushed. All those people lost their jobs.
Exactly.
Investors lost all their money.
All the partners lost their money.
They lost everything on a case that was reversed 9-0 by the United States Supreme Court that Mr. Weissman was in charge of.
Yes, and Andersen had been known to be the hallmark, the benchmark for accounting standards. Andersen was the gold standard for accounting, a venerable accounting firm.
Merrill Lynch, you mentioned. Was Weissman involved in that?
Oh, yes.
What happened to Merrill Lynch?
Merrill Lynch was indicted, well, not the company, but I think one of the reasons they indicted Andersen was to send a message to other companies that if they knocked on your door, if the Enron Task Force knocked on your door, you'd better cooperate or you could be destroyed and given the death penalty just like Andersen was.
But even if you don't know anything and you didn't do anything.
Exactly.
That's the power.
That is the power.
That a handful of prosecutors have.
Yes.
And you even see it today. With the indictments, when Mueller hands down indictments, it's all one-sided. People need to understand the other side doesn't have any say in it. They haven't had a chance to respond to it. Nothing's happened, but a group of government lawyers have decided to charge somebody or some entity with crimes. That's the beginning of the process. It's not the end of the process, and I want to pursue this with you a little bit more later, because the media treat it as, well, that's it. But I want to talk about these executives with Merrill Lynch. What happened to them?
Well, essentially, Merrill Lynch offered them up as sacrificial lambs and entered into a non-prosecution agreement with the government on behalf of Merrill Lynch, the company, that was extremely onerous. In fact, they agreed to have an overseer from the Enron task force installed in Merrill Lynch for a period of 18 months to oversee everything, including the bills that the defense lawyers were submitting. They agreed that no Merrill Lynch employee could say anything that contradicted the government's view of the prosecution, which was absolutely astounding and I think illegal. And then the Merrill Lynch executive...
So the government secretes itself within the company it's investigating?
Yes.
To oversee the bills that they're paying their defense counsel?
Yes. And everything else that's going on in the company.
Sounds thoroughly unconstitutional. These four executives, they're indicted. What happens to them?
Their lives are destroyed. They went through a 10-year period of unmitigated hell. There was the investigation, and then they're indicted, and then they face trial. The trial was a circus. I detail it at length in my book.
This book?
Yes.
License to Lie.
Yes. They were tried in Houston in the wake of the
Enron.
In the wake of the Enron collapse.
People were angry.
People were furious. Anderson had just been convicted. So there was all the uproar about that. All of Houston was in turmoil because of the collapse.
So what happened to these four?
They were all convicted.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyers for the defense were like deer in headlights most of the time. They were blindsided at every turn.
By the government.
By the government. They had made repeated requests for what's called Brady material.
Mm-hmm.
Because the government holds all the cards in
Brady
a criminal
material.
Prosecution.
Yeah.
The government is legally, constitutionally, and ethically required to produce any evidence that is favorable to the defense that is within the government's possession or within its reach. Oh, no. They steadfastly denied that there was any such Brady material.
Mm-hmm.
When the defense kept making demand after demand after demand, the judge at the time, Judge Ewing Werlein, who was assigned the Merrill Lynch case, made the government produce a list of people that they had admitted might have some Brady material. And then upon further demand, he finally ordered the government to produce summaries of that material.
When we come back, I want to know ultimately what happened to these four executives. Then I want to continue to examine Mr. Weissman, because it's very, very crucial. And beyond that, how this special counsel's office is operating. Ladies and gentlemen, don't forget, most weeknights you can watch me on Levin TV.
Okay. Mark Levin there. This guy Weissman is infamous. All right. Now, he's been around a long time. They're talking about Enron. Guys, Enron happened during the George W. Bush administration. There are, excluding Robert Mueller himself, I think 18 lawyers, principal attorneys on his task force. Now, there are a lot of junior prosecutors and deputy prosecutors and stuff from the Justice Department that they farm out this work to at some point. But it's these guys, these are the heads. Now, this impartial and objective panel are 18 lawyers who are Hillary Clinton donors, confirmed Hillary Clinton donors. Democrats. Bob Mueller, confidant of the Clintons, former FBI director. I think he was appointed by Bill Clinton. Anyway, so these guys are all tight.
Oh, my God.
They're all tight with the Clintons and one others and the Democrats. And this is the impartial and objective group of individuals who have pursued this manufactured document concerning Bill Clinton that was created by the Hillary Clinton campaign, the DNC, and the Securities Truth to Perkins and Coe, and the State Department, and Bruce Orr, and Nellie Orr, and GPS Fusion, and Christopher Steele. Oh, my God, don't get me going on that again. All right, so anyway, you get the idea. These guys have been around. The point I'm trying to make is these guys are really, really bad, corrupt guys, abusers of power. How they've stayed in power and maintained these positions, I don't know, because this is not news. What we talked about tonight is not news. It's news to us, and there were some things I did not know about this guy, but, I mean, I was familiar with Enron. I didn't realize he was one of the principal inquisitors behind that, and they stay in power. These are the men, America, who are dangerous to the Republic. These are the threats. The nameless, faceless, powerful and influential. The embedded, the entrenched. They operate with impunity. Okay, well, moving on from that. We have the government's back open for business, and a lot of people are really jacked up about this. And they say it's a cave. They there's the case to be made for a cave there. And I'm not going to deny that. And from a standpoint of optics and from a standpoint of, positions in the, and when I say positions, I mean, well, posturing in the past. Let's put it that way. It is a case. And we can make that case. And the Democrats are crowing. And they're all... ululating on each other and it's the Kobayashi Maru. It's the no win scenario. But perhaps there is a way to circumvent the Kobayashi Maru test. And it may be that the president's found it. But so the Rose Garden, he goes to the Rose Garden, and the president says, here's what we're going to do. 21 days. We're going to reopen the government for 21 days, limited time only. And in this 21 days, we've got some people that are going to get together and are going to talk about what we need to do to pass this continuing resolution. And let me tell you something else, guys. This is not a budget issue. This doesn't have anything to do with the budget. These clowns haven't fixed a budget in I don't know how long. This is a continuing resolution. That's not a budget. That's just kicking the can down the road. So anyway, Thomas Lifson, an American thinker, has another spin on it. And I read this a couple of times, and I'm inclined to agree. And if nothing else, well, we'll get to that. President Trump's Rose Garden declaration of an end of the partial shutdown was a tactical retreat, a rejection of a little bighorn strategy. It was a no-win situation, and so, excuse me, rather than bear unacceptable costs, what the president has done, it appears, is he has redefined the contest on better terms, and he sends the issue to a House and Senate committee, a conference committee, that are charged with the task of coming up with this deal, some kind of deal, that number one, prevents a resumption of the shutdown and provides border security, something that the Democrats say they believe is important. It's also important when we take into account that Nancy Pelosi has declined to rule out funding for a physical barrier. We don't know, and this is all speculation, even at this late date, because this happened a couple days back, as you know. We don't know what was said in the process of reaching this agreement to restart the government. But the Democrats, as I said, they're gloating, they're dancing in the street and handing out candy to little children. They say it's a surrender. Chuck Schumer says he hopes that the president has learned his lesson. And they worship at the altar of Nancy Pelosi now. And they're you know, so they got this, they're basking in the afterglow right now. They got this sugar high going on. And what's really happening is that they are giving us simply further evidence for future use that demonstrates that their real priority is humiliating Donald Trump, not attending to the needs of what's good for the Republic and her citizens. But nonetheless, as President Trump correctly noted in the Rose Gardens address, it is an agreement. The Democrats agreed to procedural rules that can be made to make the case for a border barrier construction. They'll hash out the deal in a conference committee, which will then submit the same legislation to both houses of Congress with the 21-day clock ticking. Either chamber can modify the legislation if they want, but all that happens under the gun of the ticking clock. Trump's stonewall on the shutdown had to end because there was a choke point that had been discovered by the opposition. And that choke point had to do with commercial aviation. It was obvious when the air traffic controllers demonstrated their abilities to stymie air travel at the nation's busiest airports, you know, President Trump, having declared ownership of this thing, would be blamed for strangling the economy, and he would be on the hook for any, God forbid, air control disaster that might happen. The executive vice president of the Air Traffic Controllers Association goes on CNN to blame Trump for delays. The Super Bowl is next weekend in the city with the world's busiest airport. A lot of bad things could happen. So, again, he makes a tactical retreat. He redefines things. Now, it could be coincidence, but this kill shot job action occurred in the wake of extraordinary signs, and we've talked about them in the past, that House Democrats were waving. You've seen the clips, or heard rather, the clips that we've played, you know, in some of the Democrats wavering in their support of this not $1 opposition while the government is partially shut down. This gives Trump's allies something to work with. Steny Hoyer, who is the second ranking House Democrat under Pelosi, has admitted, and we've heard him say it, you know, a physical barrier is part of the solution, just not during the shutdown. So the Democrats now control the House. They own the House majority because new members wound up getting elected from historically GOP-leaning districts, and many of those freshmen, these new Democrats in the House, are worried about facing voters next year and being painted as Pelosi's pawns who prevented a border barrier that was desired by their constituents. So in other words, yeah, we're going to go a little bit with Nancy. But if they want to stay in that district, they're going to have to watch their step. And if they do something a little too left-wing loopy, they run the risk of getting voted out here real soon, and they don't want that to happen. So the conference committee members that we see from the Senate, well, the committee itself, yeah, from the Senate, the Republicans are Richard Shelby from Alabama, Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, Roy Blunt of Missouri, and John Haven of North Dakota. The Democrats, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Dick Durbin of Illinois, John Tester of Montana. Tester won re-election in Montana, but he can't afford to be too far left. Leahy is the biggest camera hog in the group. Dick Durbin, a chronic schemer. None of the Republicans are among the highest profiles in the Senate, but that doesn't mean we must underrate them. Now, it's possible that this conference committee won't be able to come up with anything that satisfies both parties. In that case, the shutdown will continue, but this time, with the Democrats shown to be willing to shut down the government in order to prevent a border barrier, that's not going to look good. And Trump will have met their demand to resume government funding, and they will have refused to have met him halfway. He will be delivering the State of the Union address. As a matter of fact, Nancy Pelosi has already sent him a written invitation of such. I think it will take place on the 5th. This will allow the highest possible platform for the president to comment on the negotiations with Nancy Pelosi sitting right behind him. Will the Democrats refuse to give Trump the funds he wants for something that his base would accept as a reasonable start, like they said? No, they might. In which case, the government will be shut down again. Federal workers having received their back pay, but facing another bout of financial hard times. Would he pull the trigger on a national emergency declaration? And if he does, the Democrats will find a Ninth Circuit judge who believes that he has the power to overrule the statutory authority clearly granted to the president. So I don't know what's going to happen. There'll be a back and forth on this, but I think it's going to work out. Anyway, we've got, I think, 18 more days to find out what's going on. And we're down to the bottom of the hour, so we're going to take a little break. I got to get something to drink, quite frankly. All this talking makes a man thirsty. And we will be back. Maybe. I hate it when Blog Talk is a little balky. But here we are, and there you go, back after this brief musical interlude with more of ACP. Hey, James Bostic here, Conservative Perspective. I think one of my favorite scenes in just about any movie, one of my favorite movies, Mars Attacks. The Martians are, they've come to Vegas, and Tom Jones is doing his show, and he's got the chicks in the background doing their thing, and all of a sudden the lights go out on the stage, and when they come back up, the chicks are gone, and the Martians are there and start shooting up the place. James Bostic, a Conservative's Perspective here, live Tuesday. Pretty daggone cold Tuesday here in the Mountain State. No school. It's already closed down half the counties in the state. I was just checking out one of the let me pull that up here. There may be some West Virginians listening. I don't know. Gee whiz, I'm going to say 75-80% of all Raleigh, of all schools in West Virginia are going to be closed. There are 55 counties, and we're at least two-thirds of the way there, 70-80%. It's just so cold. You know, that stuff has just dropped down the polar express, polar vortex, whatever it is. Anyway, and it's even colder the further north you go. Up towards the New England states. It's even worse than what we got it here. We're getting off pretty lucky. Well, let's see. Had some other stuff rolled up here to talk about. And let's go take a look at what that is. Ruth Ginsburg. Anybody seen Ruth Ginsburg lately? No. No, we haven't. And I'm not exactly sure. I don't know what to think here. I don't believe that she is dead. Not yet. I believe that she is, in all likelihood, dying. It's been 54 days since we've laid eyes on the 85-year-old Supreme Court justice. And it's not just me that's saying this, but other people are, you know, they're looking for proof that she's alive. I think she might be barely alive. I think she's dying. I think she's probably incapacitated too to do the cancer. But the last time she was seen was December 6th last year when she heard arguments at the court. Since then, she underwent surgery on the 21st of December. Right before Christmas. And they did a lobectomy, and they removed two lobes on, I think, her left one. All the official statements say she's doing great, she's recovering, working quietly. She missed oral arguments this month for the first time in her 25-year career on the bench, and it's starting to raise some anxiety about how well and if she is recovering. It's been reported that the White House is taking steps toward preparing a short list of Supreme Court nominees in the event of Justice Ginsburg's death or departure from the bench. Adding even more fuel to the speculation, Fox and Friends accidentally showed a memorial graphic claiming that Ginsburg is dead. The show apologized, blamed it on a control room error, but it's worth noting that, you know, the fact that that kind of thing is even already made up beforehand and ready to go, okay, how'd that get up on the screen? Dude pushed a button, he clicked a mouse, and there it went. So that meant he had access to that. He had, you know, he had a choice of things he could run. That was one of them. So it's in there. And that's kind of creepy. But anyway, that's how that works. It could have been an accident. It could have been. They did that with Bob Hope. I think C-SPAN had made an announcement. They were talking in Congress about something, and C-SPAN interrupted to say that Bob Hope was dead. And he was, and he didn't die for another year, But in Ruth Bader Ginsburg's case, the reason that her absence is so monumental is if her health has compromised her ability to do her job as a member of the highest court in the United States, Her removal will give President Trump his third Supreme Court justice nomination of his first term. Now, that may not seem like a particularly significant thing with all the sensational things we see in the headlines throughout the... Well, the president calls it fake news. In the old days, when things were a little bit more sophisticated, we called it propaganda because it was, you know, a combination of a lot of different things. It was a combination of misinformation, of disinformation. It was of division. It was of controlling a narrative. All these things we see, all these things that the president has accurately accused a large portion of the establishment media of being guilty of. Yeah, fake news. Propaganda. That would be huge for these guys. It would be an apocalypse. In no small measure. I mean, seriously, it would be, they think if they're not talking about it because they fear it so, and they see it, and they don't want it. They really don't. There were people actually volunteering to donate organs to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, thinking that was going to keep her. You know, they're going to have what? They're going to have Ruth Bader Ginsburg's head in a jar. So anyway, this is phenomenal. This is great if this happens. But again, like I said, it's not talked about in the news because the Democrats fear this concept. They understand it. They recognize it. They see it. The reality is there. They would have the most, they would be looking, all of us would really, would be looking at the most conservative Supreme Court in modern history, and it would be that way for decades to come. If you thought the Kavanaugh nomination was tough and a brouhaha and tumult, as Levin used, he used the word tumult in that clip. I like that. I'm going to bring that one back. I like tumult. Brouhaha. Falderall. Monkey shines. Rhubarb. That's a good one. Okay, so anyway. So it's going to be monstrous. And again, we had a tie-in with the Catholics that we talked about last week. I'm not going to touch on that right now. But we are going to go back to that at some point. Just keep your eye on all the negative news you see about Catholics and Catholicism. From the time of those kids at Covington High School to what's happening now. So... there are those folks who think that this was one of the reasons, this was one of the things that motivated Nancy Pelosi into postponing the State of the Union address, was because if he'd had the State of the Union address as they were supposed to, maybe we would have seen an empty chair where Ruth Bader Ginsburg is supposed to be falling asleep. Not the big sleep. The big sleep. No, not the big sleep, but okay, anyway. So it's not required. Attendance is not required by the justices. But it would really look bad if, you know, we're watching this on Fox News or ABC or wherever, and they're panning around to show everybody that you're representing the union, and RBG's not around. And nobody's saying what's going on. But, well, you know, just feeling a little under the weather from this massive lobectomy, and we just thought it might be, you know, just keep her home. Make any mistake about this. I don't wish this woman any ill will, and I know that nobody in the listening audience is jumping up and down and cheering at this woman's demise. But there are some legitimate questions here, giving her position in the United States government. I mean, she's a justice on the Supreme Court. The highest court in the land, the court that administers the Constitution. It is set up with a specific number of judges for a reason. And if she is not able to fulfill her responsibilities, God forbid, then something's going to have to be done. What might that be? Well, again, since we got a little bit of time, and there is a short list, and I don't want to say the conventional thinking, but the inside baseball people kind of think that when the time comes, which may be, you know, here soon, to make a decision concerning a nomination to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the individual who has the inside track at this point is a woman named Amy Comey Barrett. She is Catholic. And this is where I think that just watch and see how much Catholics are dissed here. And what's going on with them? Because I believe that, you know, Amy Comey Barrett is a Catholic. Brett Kavanaugh, also Catholic, I think. And a conservative Supreme Court is pure anathema to people like Nancy Pelosi and to Chuck Schumer and you know, the left, okay? The left. And that's what we're talking about. When we talk about the leadership of the Democrat Party, they're the left. I see folks on my news feed that I've gone to school with, that I've known all my life. And they vote Democrat. And their dad and mom were Democrats, and grandmother and grandfather were Democrats, and on down the line. That's the political lineage, overwhelmingly, of their family, and that's what they do, and they vote Democrat. The only problem is they are being betrayed by the people that they're voting for, just as Republicans are being betrayed by some of the people they vote for. And that's the truth. And it's regrettable because some of these guys are really good at it. And they'll tell you what you want to hear. They'll fight for you. If somebody says he's going to fight for you, do not vote for them. He's not going to fight for you. He's not fighting for anybody but himself. This is where I would scream about term limits. And the only reason that I advocate, and here's the thing I think about this, because you have the, I'm getting a little far afield here, but I'm that's just where I'm going. You know what? I'm just going to completely change gears because I've totally lost my train of thought. what we were talking about the Supreme Court, you know, a conservative Supreme Court would make the Democrats scream bloody murder. And you think about, well, and let's just take the issue of gun rights while we're talking about that. A lot of places are becoming really restrictive on Second Amendment rights. A lot of universities are becoming unbelievably Hitler-esque in their extinguishing the First Amendment. And all these things are going to happen, and they're going to play out the way they play out. And it's, you know, I think a lot of these things will be defeated as they come up because there's an awareness. People, hey, this is the law that they're getting ready to pass and what they're going to vote on. this is what it really means. We don't want this, and you need to call your representatives and Vox Populi. We voted them in. That's how they, that's the only way they get there. Okay? We voted them in. We can vote them out. And you say, well, yeah, but he knows what's going on. If we'd have just another freshman congressman, freshman senator, didn't know anything, wouldn't know how to get anything. There wouldn't be no Robert Byrd, man. They wouldn't get nothing for a state or nothing. Wouldn't bring home no pork, man. Well, okay, maybe not. But look, if they're not doing what we want them to do, okay, I'm making a hypothetical. Joe Manchin says, hey, I'm with you cats on border security. I'm in West Virginia, and I've been around you guys all my life, except for these last four or five, so that I've been living really high and good in D.C. But you know me. It's an old job. Here's my hunting rifle. You want me to shoot an illegal alien? I'm with you. Well, okay, Joe, no, we don't want you to shoot an illegal alien, but, you know, don't let him stay here. Don't give him a bunch of handouts. I'm your guy. All right, well, okay. So Democrat Joe Manchin goes to Washington. Well, you know, Joe Manchin gets up there, and he does not follow the mandate of his constituency. We don't just leave his monkey ass up there. You vote him out. You find another, you field another candidate, and you vote him out. You don't have to listen to his slick political ads. You don't have to pay any attention to his robocalls. You don't have to look at the stuff he sends you in the mail. You find another candidate. You check them out, do a better job. You try and vet them as best you can. And you replace them. The countermand amendments, the Article 5 conventions, term limits, all these things. And you know what? Yeah, they are mechanisms that were designed and can be used procedurally for course correction. They're part of all of that. Yes, a total brown nose. Joe's gotten, yeah, Melissa, one of our producers, said Joe Manchin's a brown nose, and she's absolutely right. Here's the deal. Joe likes it in Washington. So when it comes time for re-election, Joe's going to come back, and he's going to make it look good. Joe is a politician. Politicians are a necessary evil. Because, you know, what we're talking about when we talk about government is politics. It's how things get done. But they talk about all these things. And again, you vote him in, you can vote him out. I mean, to me, it's pretty simple. But it doesn't seem to work. Oh, well, on the rare occasions, you'll find some guy, you know, who's been corrupt, and it's just, you know, it's so egregious. Yeah. But usually in that case, if it's that bad, he's imprisoned. I mean, he's placed under arrest. He's removed from office by law enforcement, not by the voice of the people. But you vote him in, you can vote him out. Yeah, we only got about 4 minutes left. I had a few other things I want to talk about, but you can bet I'm not going to roll all that crap together in 4 minutes. You know what we are going to do? I'll tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to play this. I'm just going to play it right now. If you're a patriot, get a tissue.
United States dollar took another pounding on German, French, and British exchanges this morning, hitting the lowest point ever known in West Germany. It has declined there by 41% since 1971, and this Canadian thinks it's time to speak up for the Americans as the most generous and possibly the least appreciated people in all the world. As long as 60 years ago, when I first started to read newspapers, I read of floods on the Yellow River and the Yangtze. Well, who rushed in with men and money to help? The Americans did, that's who. They have helped control floods on the Nile, the Amazon, the Ganges, and the Niger. Today, the rich bottom land of the Mississippi is underwater, and no foreign land has sent a dollar to help. Germany, Japan, and to a lesser extent, Britain and Italy, were lifted out of the debris of war by the Americans, who poured in billions of dollars and forgave other billions in debts. None of those countries is today paying even the interest on its remaining debts to the United States. When the franc was in danger of collapsing in 1956, it was the Americans who propped it up, and their reward was to be insulted and swindled on the streets of Paris. And I was there. I saw that. When distant cities are hit by earthquake, it's the United States that hurries in to help. Managua, Nicaragua is one of the most recent examples. So far this spring, 59 American communities have been flattened by tornadoes. Nobody has helped. The Marshall Plan, the Truman Policy, all pump billions upon billions of dollars into discouraged countries. And now newspapers in those countries are writing about the decadent, war-mongering Americans. Now, I'd like to see just one of those countries that is gloating over the erosion of the United States dollar build its own airplane. Come on now, you, let's hear it. Does any country in the world have a plane to equal a Boeing jumbo jet, the Lockheed TriStar, or the Douglas 10? If so, why don't they fly them? Why do all international lines except Russia fly American planes? Why does no other land on Earth even consider putting a man or a woman on the moon? You talk about Japanese technocracy and you get radios. You talk about German technocracy and you get automobiles. You talk about American technocracy and you find men on the moon not once but several times and safely home again. You talk about scandals and the Americans put theirs right in the store window for everybody to look at. Even the draft dodgers are not pursued and hounded. They're right here on our streets in Toronto. Most of them, unless they're breaking Canadian laws, are getting American dollars from Ma and Pa at home to spend up here. When the Americans get out of this bind, as they will, who could blame them if they said to hell with the rest of the world? Let somebody else buy the bonds. Let somebody else build or repair foreign dams or design foreign buildings that won't shake apart in earthquakes. When the railways of France and Germany and India were breaking down through age, it was the Americans who rebuilt them. When the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central went broke, nobody loaned them an old caboose. Both of them are still broke. I can name to you 5,000 times when the Americans raced to the help of other people in trouble. Can you name to me even one time when someone else raced to the Americans in trouble? I don't think there was outside help even during the San Francisco earthquake. Our neighbors have faced it alone, and I'm one Canadian who is damn tired of hearing them kicked around. They'll come out of this thing with their flag high, and when they do, they're entitled to thumb their noses at the lands that are gloating over their present troubles. I hope Canada is not one of these. But there are many smug, self-righteous Canadians. And finally, the American Red Cross was told at its 48th annual meeting in New Orleans this morning that it was broke. This year's disaster, with the year less than half over, has taken it all, and nobody, but nobody, has helped.
Pardon me while I dab a tear from my glass eye. Now, I got to tell you a little story about this. I came across this the other day, and I put it away. This is a true story. Never told the story. And besides, incidentally, this is the first time in the entire time, which has been about 4 years, almost 5 years, that I've been doing a live version of the show, that I've gone long, man. I've gone into extra minutes. So here's what we're doing. All right, but no, this guy was a Canadian, and his name was Gordon St. Clair. And Mr. St. Clair was an established Canadian broadcaster. And in 1973, at the age of 73, Mr. St. Clair did this radio commentary. And this was his commentary. And it was picked up by some stations across the border in Detroit and those areas, and they started playing it. And then it got in its final incarnation, you know, with the patriotic music there with the battle hymn going in the background, and they had him do it. And it was massive. And a lot of you guys don't know anything about this. Again, the average median age in the United States is about 38 years old, and this was 1973. I was a precocious 10 years old, 11 years old, when this thing came out. I mean, it was on – I've got to go back digging into the time vault again. It was on American Top 40. It made the Top 40 with Casey Kasem. Keep your feet on the ground. Keep reaching for cigars. So it's massive. It's huge. And it was at a time when America was at a low ebb. We were dealing with the scandal of what had happened at Watergate. We were coming to the end of the Vietnam War. Things were not going well there either. We had a lot of cultural upheaval at home because of the war and because of a lot of other things. And it was really kind of the beginning of a long kicking around that the United States went through during the 1970s. Well, this thing had legs. And, I mean, it just went through the country. It was one of those things. It was never intended to be as huge as it was. It was just Mr. St. Clair laying it out there, speaking his mind. So we fast forward to 1974. It is the end of the school year, and I am getting ready to graduate, I guess, from Lincoln Elementary School in Beckley, West Virginia. And we got a show, man. We're doing a presentation. And there were a lot of things that, you know, we that happened in it. And I memorized, oh yes, I memorized Mr. St. Clair's speech. I had it with me, I had it down, and I read it a million times, and I delivered, as part of our sixth grade commencement ceremony, this guy's speech about the Americans. I killed it. There were moms and dads, I mean, you know, the teachers and the principal, everybody's there, and I'm on this stage standing there alone. Plaid sport coat, bow tie. Well, it was 1974. Okay. I thought I looked like Lee Majors. But anyway. I gave this speech. And hadn't thought about that in years, and I was going through something on my feed. And somebody had posted it on one of the conservative sites I like to look at. And somebody had posted it and it just sent back a flood of memories. You know what, man? I'm going to find that, and I'm going to download that. And that's the first time I made sure it was the copy that I wanted. And then I loaded it up, and that was the first time that I listened to it in its entirety since I found it. And it's probably the first time that I've listened to it. I won't say since 1974, but maybe 30 years or so at least. Been a long time. But what this guy said then, rings no less true today. You change the names of some of the actors. You know, it's like Dragnet. The names are changed. The story's true. It always is. The names are changed to protect the innocent. And because while they may be ever-changing, they are also ever-guilty. Wow. It's been a long, long time since I thought about that. Okay, well, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and cut it loose here. I am completely out of gas now that I've had this really remarkable, awesome reminiscence of my formative elementary school years. Thanks for letting me share that. I'm going to go ahead and close things up. We'll be back Thursday. You know, we do this live Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Time here, Blog Talk Radio. You can go to blogtalkradio.com and you type in Patriot Nation Radio and ACP's here Tuesdays, Thursdays, live 7 p.m. Thank you, all the listeners. We also have a recorded version of the program that goes out over the Talk America Radio Network. And you can go to talkamericaradio.org and check them out. There are two audio streams. There, the Liberty and the Justice stream. And ACP can be heard on either one of those various times throughout the week. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate it tremendously. I always look forward to the time I get to talk about stuff. We'll see you again Thursday, coming up here in just a couple of days if we don't freeze to death. Right here, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative perspective. God bless you all. God bless America.